Let's move on to our text. Before we look at it directly, it's important to understand how it fits in the overall biblical narrative. You see, God worked through Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, all four of them, to record the events of Jesus' life. While not biographies like we would think about them, they are accurate records of what he did and said. However, each one of these writers wrote to a different audience in different circumstances, and though they tell one story, each one has different themes and a different focus. And while they overlap many times, each one provides their own unique contributions. For example, we're studying Luke, and I think it's something like there are 19 parables and 6 miracles that Luke records that the other gospels don't record. And yet, he leaves things out. For example, he doesn't mention Jesus walking on the water, and he's silent about the story and the death of John the Baptist. So it really isn't that often that they all cover the same event. Think about it. I mean, even the whole birth narrative is left out of the Gospel of Mark. Yet today, we come to one event that they all record. In fact, it's commonly noted it's the only miracle other than the resurrection that all four authors were led to record. Think about that. Water to wine, the man lowered through the roof, the calming of the sea, all these great miracles that we know and think about, and yet this is the only one that's in all four. On the other hand, while all four tell the event, each one has a little different perspective. Each adds different details. For example, only John records that the bread and fish come from a boy. Only Luke notes that it happened near the town of Bethsaida. Matthew relates that this happens right after John the Baptist's death. And only Mark adds that some of the crowd ran ahead to meet them. And yet they stand united. They stand united in the overall picture. Let's look at the ways that they are united. First of all, they're united on the number of people involved, 5,000 men, and they all say it that way. And it isn't a slight to women and children, but rather a way of counting. Many times it represents households. In any case, it is only the starting point. And when you add women and children, various authors have given a crowd size from 10,000 to 20,000. We're not sure, but it's a stinking lot of people. And they're united on the actions of crowd. Despite the attention that all the crowd gets, despite us thinking about the 5,000 men, the 20,000 people, the crowd wasn't invited. But they still followed them. While Jesus proposed that he and his disciples get away to a quiet place, all the Gospels note that the crowd learned of the plans and they followed them. It's interesting then, they're also united on Jesus' compassion. They all record Jesus' kindness towards the crowd. It's interesting that a couple different words are used. In Matthew and Mark, the word actually is best translated as compassion, emphasizing Christ's sympathy and love for the crowd. But here in Luke, it's a different word, correctly translated as we read today as welcomed, emphasizing that Jesus gladly accepted the crowd. And so here we get a great example of great unity found in the different Gospels. A common event, through the diversity of writers, we get a fuller understanding of what is going on. Jesus not only had compassion, but he openly welcomed them. Excuse me. And they're also united on the amount of food. 5 loaves and 2 fish. The number of people contrasted with the meager amount of food. And despite some critics' comments, there was no other food around. As we will see in a moment, the disciples had a chance to look around. And you think about it, them not having food, that kind of makes sense with the scenario. After all, Jesus, at least to everybody else, had left on the spur of the moment. And the people were not planning to go anywhere. Rather, they saw Jesus leave and they ran after him. They had no time to pack anything. They go on to being united upon Jesus giving thanks. Oops. 5. There. They're united on Jesus giving thanks. Now, this occurs before the miracle happens, meaning nothing had multiplied yet. Jesus stood there in front of a crowd of 10 to 20,000 people with 5 loaves and 2 fish. I don't know how big those fish were, but they're not that big. And yet he gave thanks. Can you imagine what the disciples were thinking? How can he give thanks for such a meager meal? And they're also united on Jesus' organization of the crowd. Jesus had them sit down, not in mass, not where you are, but rather in groups of 50 to 100 people each. And this is the closest we get to any information on how this miracle happened, at least logistically. And it kind of makes sense. I mean, it ends up being maybe a groups of 200 to 300 groups. So instead of thinking of a line of 10 to 20,000 people lining up to get their food, think of 200 to 300 groups there. Now divide 200 to 300 groups by 12, because there were 12 disciples that were going to serve them. Now, this isn't in the text, none of the 4 texts. But I like to think about it of being 240 groups. 12 apostles, 20 people for each group. Again, I'm making this up, but it kind of fits the scenario. And each group, I don't think the apostles necessarily had to go out to each group. Each group sends up a representative with their group and with the number of food that they meet. And I just imagine the apostles standing there with 12 apostles out there with 20 people in front of them, and they're going, okay, how many do you need? Oh, there's 57 in your group? Jesus, I need 50. Oh, okay, thank you. Okay, next, 93. Oh, there's 90. Not once, not twice, but over and over again. They went back to Jesus, and there was still food. I mean, God could have made the point much easier. If it had only been 100 people, there still wouldn't have been enough food. But he so chose 10 to 20,000 people to emphasize the point of his provision. And interestingly, they're united on the satisfaction of the crowd. As Luke records in verse 17, they all ate and were satisfied. You see, it isn't some light snack to hold them over, and it wasn't just the neediest got something, but everyone was satisfied. And that word satisfied means to be filled. It's the same word that Matthew uses in the Beatitudes when he records Christ's words, "Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be filled." These people were filled, they were satisfied. And not only were they satisfied, but the authors are all remarkably united about the amount of leftovers. Verse 17 goes on to say, the disciples picked up 12 baskets full. Get the picture? How many disciples were there? 12. How many baskets full were there? Okay. Now, about the baskets. Don't think that the littlest details don't mean something. You see, the term here is not a big basket you might see in the marketplace. Now, interestingly, that word is used. The big basket word is used in the feeding of the 4,000 later, where they picked up 7 basketfuls. They had 7 full baskets, but here, the word is different. It's commonly used for a smaller wicker basket that often the Jews were accustomed to carry their food in, their personal lunchbox. Although it may last for a little bit long, especially when they were on a journey. And so while none of the disciples had anything when they started, they now, after feeding 20,000 people, not only had enough for their own filling for that day, but they also had enough for the journey ahead. And so while this is a story of God's massive provision, it's also a story of God taking care of even the smallest details. And all 4 writers give us different views of this event, but they're unified in these facts. And you know, these facts would be enough. After all, there are many applications to our life that we can pull from just the study of those facts. In fact, it would have been enough just to say that Jesus fed 20,000 people. That is a miracle. But there's one more thing that they all recorded and that we want to take a look at today. Now, it isn't the prettiest fact. Now, I have to admit, if I was one of the disciples and Luke was interviewing me for writing this, I might not have brought this part up. But they all stand united in showing the disciples' failure. They make clear that these people who had seen and heard Jesus, who had been picked by the master himself, these who had seen Jesus heal, cast out demons, who had seen him do so many things, these 12, to the person, could not look beyond their current problem. All they could say was, oh, it's too late. Hey, you preach too long. Oh, hey, this place has nothing. Who picked this place? Oh, it would take us 6 months to earn enough money to buy all these people food. It's just too much money. They stand united at the fact that instead of looking to Jesus, they look to the world around them. And you see, these are not just casual comments. These are studied observations, as we'll see in a moment. They had some time to think about it, to evaluate the situation. Still, the disciples were unable to come up with anything. They couldn't even get the crowd organized. Jesus had to tell them everything, step by step, what to do. And so this miracle was an amazing sign to 20,000 people. That day, 20,000 people learned about Jesus' compassion, about his love, his welcoming spirit, about God's abundant provision. But to the 12, it was more than that. It was also heartbreaking, but a teachable moment for them. And so today, I would like us to look at this not from the viewpoint of the crowd, but instead, let's look at the viewpoint of the 12. So let's look real closely at the text today. The first phrase there kind of hits you. It says, when the apostles returned. But returned from what? Remember, this is not a set of stories, but this is a long narrative that Luke put together. That's why we read the whole chapter there. But they returned from a trip that Jesus sent them on. He sent them out to proclaim the gospel, the kingdom of God, and to heal the sick. Jesus had just sent them off on a short-term mission. Short-term missions are exciting. We highly encourage them. They might have some next year. And we've gone off with a few of you on many of them. You come back tired and excited, and that was the disciples. They were excited. After all, they had been very successful. So many people were talking about what was going on that even Herod had heard about it. And so this is our context. They had just returned. They had just returned. And as verse 10 goes on to say, they reported to Jesus what they had done. The word here for reported means a narration or a complete report. It wasn't just giving high fives and this is great and all that, but they were telling in detail to Jesus and to the others what was going on. But Mark tells us that even before they could say much, there were crowds there where they started. In fact, Mark says, because so many people were coming and going, they did not even have a chance to eat. Then Jesus says they should go off to a quieter place. So you get the picture. They're in spot A. There are crowds there, and they can't get anything done. And so they move off by boat across the lake, and they end up near a spot near Bethsaida. However, in the text comes an interesting word, but. Have you ever noticed how annoying that word is? You can completely change the course of a sentence, for good or for bad, with those three little letters. I was going to give you a raise, but, or I was going to come over, but. And in this case, they moved to get away from the crowd, but. But the crowd learned about it and followed them. In fact, Mark tells us that some of the people actually ran ahead and got there ahead of them. There were crowds waiting for them when they got there. Can you imagine how the disciples felt? They were excited about what they had done and probably exhausted, and now they weren't even getting their me time. The crowd had intruded upon their time. And now it's John that records a few more details about Jesus' interplay with the disciples. In fact, it implies that Jesus brought up the subject of food early. John 6, verses 5 and 6 says, "When Jesus looked up and saw the great crowd coming toward him, he said to Philip, 'Where shall we buy bread for these people to eat?' He asked this only to test them, for he had already in mind what he was going to do. Early on, as the crowd is still gathering, he asked Philip." Philip's one of the three disciples that come from Bethsaida, so he knew the area. He asked Philip, "Where can we get food for all these people?" He deliberately sets it in motion. And so even though it's only a few verses in the text, there seems to be a span of time between this first interchange with Philip and the miracle. During this time, Jesus teaches and he heals many people. However, I imagine that also during this time, the disciples were scurrying around trying to figure out what to do. Andrew's the only one that even had a little good news. He's the one that finds the boy. 5 loaves and 2 fish, probably packed in his little basket. And this is where Luke picks up the narrative. The apostles, after their studied approach, approach Jesus with their conclusion: "Send the crowds away." As one author notes, this appears to be the first church committee meeting. And you note, they got it wrong. And to that, Jesus responds with a simple statement: "You give them something to eat." In Greek, it's a very simple four-word sentence, starting with the word "give." It's pretty direct, don't you think? "You give them something to eat." And yet the disciples balked. Well, not exactly balked. They took time to explain the situation to Jesus. "Okay, Lord, I heard you, but here's something you need to know." Have you noticed how often we like to explain the situation to God? "Lord, I know I should do this, but here's some facts that you need to know." God doesn't need to know the facts. He already knows it. In fact, Jesus doesn't even respond to their fine bullet point presentation. Instead, he tells the disciples to have the crowd go sit down. So you see, there really are two groups of people here: the 20,000 and the 12. And while we can spend a lot of time talking about the 20,000, I think it's the 12 that hits home the most. They learned a lot of things that day. First of all, they learned that success does not mean completion. They had a great ministry trip. Many people have been impacted. No, many people had actually been changed. They healed in Jesus' name. They taught in Jesus' name. It was fantastic. But Jesus used this to remind them that even when ministry is done, it's not over. When ministry is done, it's not over. Even when you think you have arrived, it isn't the end. And most importantly, we are never done growing at any point in time. We always have something to learn. Paul writes this in 2 Thessalonians chapter 1, verse 3 goes, "We ought to thank God for you, brothers and sisters, and rightly so, because your faith is growing more and more, and the love you have for one another is increasing." You see, you don't grow until you have faith. You don't grow until you have love. Your love and your faith continue to grow. God gives us love and faith, and it's hard at the very beginning of our Christian life, but throughout our whole life, it's never over. There is always the next thing. We are always growing. Secondly, they learned that ministry doesn't come on our timing. They had just escaped those crowds. They were ready to rest and have some relaxation, to be someplace different. But before they could even get off the boat, there were people there waiting for them. You know, it's one thing when you have time to get your thoughts together and prepare, but the crowd ran ahead and was waiting for them. To Jesus, this was normal. In Luke 8, he's just walking through a crowd and a lady touches him to be healed. In Mark 2, he's teaching in a house and all of a sudden somebody breaks the roof and the person drops in. On and on and on. Now you see, it would be foolish. It would be stupid to not make plans for ministry. You see, the Bible and even Christ talks about the importance of planning. And we do that. We plan out our ministries. We plan out our time and everything. But more importantly, this teaches us that we would be foolish to think that ministry only happens when we plan it. Ministry happens by surprise. Ministry happens when it's planned. Those things seem like oxymorons, but that's the true reality of the Christian life, because God is always moving forward. Third of all, they learned that Jesus asked the impossible. You know, it's kind of hard to blame the apostles here. I mean, 5 loaves, 2 fish, thousands of people, it is a stretch. No, it's not a stretch. It's impossible. But that is exactly what Jesus asks of us, the impossible. While we may not have to feed thousands, God asks us to do our own impossible tasks. It may be in the area of our family, our work, I don't know. But I know many of us are facing the impossible. So just fill in your own impossible situation. Because the key to facing the impossible is the next thing that they learned. They also learned that Jesus provides the resources. I made some stuff up earlier, but I really don't know how the logistics of this whole thing worked. But somehow, Jesus began to break bread. And then more bread. And then more bread. And then fish. And then bread and fish. Something happened. And probably in part was indescribable to the disciples. But that's what happened. God provides. But let's be clear on the sequence of events here. This is not some name it and claim it system situation. It isn't that God provides all of our wants and that God's provision is just overflowing for everything. Sometimes he even allows our earthly needs to be stretched. But here, first, Jesus provides the direction. You feed them. He chooses it for us. And when we follow his lead, he provides us with the resources, the strength, the ability to do his will. God leads us. And when we follow him, he provides those resources that we need. So you see, there's two sides of the miracle here. There's the 20,000 side and there's the 12. Two sides, one coin. From one side, this is a wonderful miracle, a story of God's compassion, his welcoming style, his impossible provision, and those are all true. From another angle, it is a story of our failure of faith. A story how even those closest to Jesus, those who've had such fantastic ministries, how even we can and often fail, even when we've just had a success. And that takes us back to bowling. You see, our grandkids were quite happy with their scores. Garnett's 4, Charlotte's 2. Garnett actually had a couple good frames. And there were high fives and cheers and ice cream. Of course, there was ice cream, okay? And with all that enthusiasm, they could be content with their scores. And so with no further work, no follow-up, they could cruise through life, never play again, and in 60 years, they could end up with their grandfather's award-winning score of 112. Yeah, not very good, huh? You get the point. You can't be a bowler without working on your bowling. Even when you have a good frame, you need to follow up with work. not just for one frame more, not for one game more, but over and over and over. And you don't stop. You don't get to a point in bowling and then say, I've achieved it. You got to a 190, I'm happy with that score. Never bowl again and then come back 20 years later and try to bowl a 190. That's not going to happen, is it? When I was younger, I used to bowl a lot. Never that great, but I had my own ball and equipment. I even once bowled a pretty good game, certainly better than 112. But I didn't bowl again for a long time, so I can, to this day, I can beat a four-year-old, but not by that much, so. As the worship team comes up, let's think about this picture. You see, it's another view of this parable. We took this picture while we were in Galveston this summer. And why this is another view of this parable is because it is a sunrise, not a sunset. That's what the disciples learned. You have a bright spot, a successful ministry, things that are happening that are exciting, yet it isn't an end. It isn't a sunset. It's a start. It's a sunrise. Sometimes our impossible situation is big. Sometimes it is small. It can be our health, our family, our neighbors. It may not even sound spiritual. After all, he used a bunch of hungry people to lead the disciples into better faith. But Jesus is leading us into new areas. Even when we think we are not ready, even when it approaches us by surprise, even when we think we're done, God brings us new, exciting adventures. Let's open ourselves up to those adventures.